the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
Welcome to What Radicalized You, a podcast of stories and experiences that have shaped people's ideas about our world and the way society should function.
My name is Anais, and you might know me as my social media alias, Bint Falestine. I am a Palestinian first and foremost, and a filmmaker, up and coming, hopefully. And I am an organizer based out of the Boston area, and I'm also navigating the social media and internet organizing spaces. And I would say what radicalized me was a series of moments, but most notably growing up in predominantly white institutions that were never made for me, for my family, for people that look like us, and having to navigate those spaces at an early age and seeing the world around me through my parents' eyes, who are immigrants, refugees, or descendants of refugees. So my mother and father, or our mother and father, are both Palestinian. Our father immigrated to the States, refugee family in Jordan, and our mother is the daughter of a Palestinian refugee in the United States. And I just think that that framework for me from a young age allowed me, I might not have known it back then when I was a child, but now I do, that the world and the spaces that we're a part of, we have to demand our presence and we have to make sure that it's known. And so haven't always been unapologetically Palestinian. I went through a phase of hiding who I was, of being ashamed, of being bullied essentially into hiding that I was Palestinian, hiding that I was a Muslim living in America, and essentially just trying to water down who I was. And then a really catalytic moment for me was in high school. I was a freshman eighth grade going into high school, and I had written an article on Palestine. They had asked me to write an article on Palestine for the school newspaper, and I was censored. My whole paper, the whole article, was an op-ed on the war on Gaza that had just taken place in the summer. And it was essentially all of the factual evidence was taken out. All of my opinions were censored and taken out. And what was published was not what I had written. And there was an article that was supposed to be, I guess, the sister article, which was the Israeli perspective on this from a Jewish Israeli student at my school. And I asked to see their paper that they had submitted and that was edited. And there were, you know, slim to none edits made on their paper. So essentially, I was furious. I was enraged and I needed to get out. So that's exactly what I did. And then I found my way out and into the Middle East, and I left. And I went to a boarding school in Jordan, and I essentially never looked back. So that was the most radicalizing moment, but there are a lot more. Mesa, do you want to say what radicalized you? Because I also followed into your footsteps as a Palestinian at that school and in our family. So,
yeah. So my name's Mesa. I am a Palestinian, also the child of immigrants and refugees. I am based out of the DMV, so the DC area, and I'm an active community member of various DC-based organizations, but most prominently the DC Palestinian Film and Arts Festival. I would say what radicalized me is similar and related to Anais's experience, because obviously we're sisters, but as she noted, you know, I kind of navigated these spaces a little earlier than she did. And, you know, I like to answer this question, and I've had a lot of folks ask it in different ways, but in some ways, I feel like I was radicalized from birth, which doesn't really sound intuitive, but my father and has always been politicized from, you know, what I gathered in stories growing up. And so my name Mesa is actually was given to me because my father admired the Palestinian leader, George Habash, and his name was Abu Mesa, his colloquial name, so father of Mesa in Arabic. And my father admired him so much that he said, you know, I want to name my firstborn daughter Mesa. So in ways, before I could even understand my role in this world, and particularly how I fit as an Arab, Muslim, Palestinian woman living in exile, that radical legacy of Palestinian leftist politics was like ingrained in my blood. But, you know, I'm 25. I was born in 96. And my early childhood, some of the earliest memories that I have are kind of like really dark, in the sense that early 2000 was both the second Intifada was in full swing in Palestine. And, you know, America and the Bush administration was waging an imperial war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So even though I was only 5 years old, I tell my siblings this all the time. My earliest memory is actually walking out in the middle of the night when I was young. I had like a nightmare, and I walked out to my father watching Al Jazeera, as most Arab dads or parents like did at the time, right? To stay connected to like what's happening back home. And they had on a loop the footage of Muhammad al-Durra being murdered by Israeli forces in his father's arms. And so that really stark and dark memory stayed with me at such a young age. And shortly thereafter, you know, 2001, 9/11 happened. And I was conscious enough to understand, you know, we're living in New Jersey, so not far from New York. I was conscious enough to understand that something had happened, and the way that people, my peers, treated me as an Arab, as a Muslim, and as a Palestinian changed. Immediately, there was a "this is us and you're them" type of mentality, this othering. And so it stuck with me, and I continued to witness all of these events, you know, the Second Intifada, the Iraq War, and just trying to like make sense of what does this mean for me, you know, as I live in America. And I'll close with this thought, but one of the most important things I think my father ever told me, I was young and I had gone up to him and I said, "Baba, you're always talking politics. Like, you're always so upset and you're watching the news and you're talking politics. Like, can't you talk about anything else?" And he looked at me with this like naivete almost, like he pitied me. But he said, "You know, Mesa, one day you're going to understand that the entire world revolves around power and politics." And 20 years later, like, I sit here and every single day I think about how can we name and shame and break apart these systems of power and of harm that we live in.
I feel like those memories for me aren't as, I can sometimes visualize them, like of Baba, our dad, sitting and watching Al Jazeera all the time. And I remember begging him to, like, you know, get up from the TV and come outside and play, or like take us to the corner store, or like things like that. But I just feel like for me, they weren't as, I can't remember them as well because I was a little bit younger. I'm 22, so I was born in 99. And so I do remember the aftermath, I think, more than those events happening. So I remember, you know, being surveilled and being followed, like with our mom in the car, cars following us and tailing us from home to school and school to soccer practice or ballet practice. And just like weird things happening. And I thought my mom was crazy, but like, she wasn't. And those things are real. And, you know, that as an organizer, they definitely have happened to me, where I've been tracked down and followed by and surveilled by police, etc. And so it's just crazy how everything's kind of come full circle. And I used to ask Baba, our dad, like, why all you talk about is politics. And I used to be really annoyed by it because I felt like it consumed him. And so it took him away from us and from being present with us. But it's so crazy because I feel like now I'm mimicking a lot of those behaviors and I'm just as obsessed and I'm just as glued to my phone. Maybe it's not the TV, it's my phone now because of the world we live in. But I'm just as obsessed with the news and always being up to date and keeping up and being in contact with people back home and hearing from everyone, and like just knowing to the dot what's happening and just feeling helpless. But at the same time, I feel like me and Mesa have both found some type of resolve to not feel so helpless all the time. And I think that that's where our recent radicalization comes into play, where these last few years, specifically for Palestine and cross movement building and solidarity, it's really taken a turn. And I've seen crazy growth and impact being made. And so that's kind of what it excites me about reflecting on, like, everything that has shaped me and shaped my siblings and shaped Mesa, and reflecting on that relationship that we have with one another. And like, it's crazy, but like, Mesa knows this. I didn't always, and people might not know this about me because of what they think of me from social media, but I wasn't always obsessed with Palestine. Like I said, like I used to hide it. I used to be ashamed, but there was a turning point when I found an environment that accepted and that supported my love for Palestine. And that was in Jordan, where almost more than half of the population is originally Palestinian. And so my views and everything that I kind of had suppressed was able to flourish and grow, and I could nurture my love for Palestine in a really healthy way. And so in high school, that was the first kind of experience that I had with like actual organizing work, because we had a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at my high school, which I didn't know it at the time, but it was unusual. And it's not something that high schools have. Not even in Jordan, but also not even in the States. So that space for me became like, that was my getaway, that was my escape, and that was my safe space. And then when I came back to the United States for college, I had to navigate it all over again. This really, you know, Zionist heavy rhetoric and the institutions like liberal arts colleges that are just full of Zionist donors who control like what happens in terms of campus life and campus organizing, and really having to go through the loops of like bureaucracy and stuff. And I think I learned a lot from Mesa and Mesa's work, because Mesa was the one who kind of paved the path for organizing work in our family, also from our father and his work. But I think Mesa, I would love to hear more about, if you could tell us more about your college experience, because that guided me in many ways in mine.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of super cool things, and like I'm just so happy that we're in conversation together, because I think like now as young women navigating this world, we have this ability to reflect in a way, not just on childhood, but like, you know, how we fit into spaces that we've grown into. And like, you've navigated like a very global space where you've come into yourself. And so these different environments kind of influence, right, how we found our voices as Palestinian women engaging and contributing to resistance in many, many different ways. You did mention something that had me thinking, right? So Anis mentioned experience with heavy state surveillance from a young age, where we weren't really cognizant or aware of like what that felt like, what it looked like, but we knew something was off. And to just like give that a little bit of context, you know, so after 9/11, right, it's documented very clearly, the FBI kind of constructed a whole series of programs to surveil and infiltrate different community spaces that were heavily led by Arabs, Muslims, Palestinians, you know, you name it. And New Jersey is a hub of all of those communities and is extremely close to New York. So, you know, our family came to this country in many ways, just as other immigrant families do, and became business owners, right? And so my father, I think the legacy and the impact that he's bestowed upon us is truly his explaining to us in ways he didn't even know how, class politics, right?
Yeah. So I want to say one thing. Our father has a love of giving and like mutual aid, and just like, even if he doesn't have it, he's going to give it. If we can make it just barely and someone else can also make it, then he's going to give it. And I think that I didn't get that, but now I get that and I love it. So
no, yeah, it makes so much sense because it's like, yeah, you know, our families, so we have like multiple family businesses, seafood, Middle Eastern, like halal meat market, etc., right? So we grew up in this environment where we were truly like providers, but also like staples of the community, you know, like my father and his brothers like have customers that have been coming to them for 20 plus years that know them by name. And then like, you know, the area we lived in, I would say, was truly very multicultural and definitely, you know, lower to upper middle class, depending on where you were. So, you know, experiencing, for example, the xenophobia that came out of like 9/11, right? Like, I remember so vividly as my dad is like working these long hours trying to provide for a family of five. He was also, you know, giving to people that he met along the way that were less fortunate, that had just come to this country, that were trying to get up on their feet. And in some ways, witnessing that like mutual aid, that's a very personal connection, is radical in and of itself, right? Because it's like the resources aren't that scarce and he made sure to share where he could. But I think simultaneously, the other side of that is, you know, there was a lot of hate that came towards Muslim or Arab business owners at the time. So I remember there was like an op-ed or some type of newspaper article published in our local newspaper about business owners just asking their opinions about 9/11, right? And my dad, I guess he was quoted in this article, and shortly thereafter we began receiving a barrage, like literally a barrage of hate messages, voicemails to our home phone number.
I remember, right? That I remember. Yeah. Yep.
And it was shocking because like my mom is playing back this guy who's like, go back to your home, blah blah blah, and I just remember sitting there thinking like, we can't go back, you know, like if I could go back to Palestine tomorrow, even though I was so young, I was like, I'd go in a heartbeat, but we can't. So I wanted to contextualize that, like being a staple of a community while simultaneously fighting off not only xenophobia, but like extreme state surveillance from entities that were literally embedding themselves into mosques, right? So that's another experience that you'll hear from Palestinian Americans or Arab Americans that lived in that area. The mosque that, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm religious. I do value, I think, the way that religion can shape life. But one thing that was really unique to the New Jersey experience is that many masjids were infiltrated by embeds, like intelligence embeds, right? That were trying to gather supposed information on God knows what. So the proximity to that, just I questioned a lot about power and about like whose voices were valid. And the harassment, I think, was the most unsettling part of it all. I'll end with this, but I mean, I was experiencing this in real life while simultaneously going through the American education system, learning about things like COINTELPRO, right? That a lot of people think about as separate from the reality, the modern experience that we're living right now. But like the government attacks and surveils and harasses people that they see as a threat to their hegemony. So I just made those connections from a young age, and it really did inspire me to learn more about other movements in this country and peoples that are under attack, you know?
Yeah, I feel like also because of our placement in the community and in the institutions that we were a part of, like building off of what you just said about finding other communities and learning about them, I remember growing up, me and every single one of my siblings have only ever felt most comfortable with, or most, I guess, in alignment with our Black siblings, whether that be in school and in sports practices. And I think that that for me was really pivotal, because I realized that, like, well, we're the only like Arab Muslim, you know, students at this school or whatever, but I find comfort and I find allyship in my Black peers, and they support me and they ask me and they're curious, just like I was curious. And so really pivotal moment for me as well, that helped me with my current, where I'm currently at in terms of my radicalization, was when I was, I forget how old I was, but I was pretty young. If Mesa was like, Mesa, you were like 15 when Trayvon Martin was murdered?
Just about, yeah, that was 2012, right?
Yeah, so I was like 12, 13. And I remember coming back home that day, and just in school, they had like Black Latino Student Union lunch for students who felt like trying to support the students of color at school. And I was an honorary member of that organization because there was no Palestinian students, there was no Arab students organization. And that's where I felt most welcome. So they welcomed me into that. And yeah, I love that experience. But I remember coming home that day and sitting down and writing, I think it was a poem. I either wrote a poem or like a short like blurb of how the murder of Trayvon Martin made me feel. And that sparked my curiosity of the Black liberation movement and learning more about it. And I had always heard, you know, I always heard of Malcolm X. It was like a familiar name in the house. And we heard of Muhammad Ali and we heard of all these people, but I took more initiative to learn more and find out and read. And we also were really lucky, and we are really lucky to know Dr. Cornel West really, really well. I grew up with his daughter. And so having people like that as mentors and people to look up to really, really, really catalyzed for me my personal growth and interest in Black Palestinian solidarity, for example.
Yeah.
Mesa, do you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, we mentioned earlier the institution that our high school and the high school that Anais attended briefly was predominantly white. And so I found community in amongst the people that were, you know, people of color. And I think the issue or the difficulty there was still navigating class for me. Like, that was still at the forefront of my mind. You know, we were students that were fortunate enough to have scholarships that made it possible for us to attend such an elite institution. But in the moments that I was surrounded by my peers of color, I felt like, okay, maybe I can be a little more authentically myself. And that's where I also, you know, had similar experiences to Anais. When I was in high school, you know, we witnessed the murder of Trayvon Martin. I also witnessed the illegal and brutal bombardments of Gaza in 2012 and 2014. And I felt, you know, really compelled to, one, engage in deep research on, like, you know, what is the Palestinian experience. So for me, every academic opportunity I got to write a paper on Palestine, I did. And I was also, you know, invited to do what they called a debate club, right? And at the time, I was really naive. And I was like, well, I want to talk about Palestine. I want to platform this topic, but, like, how do I do this? And, you know, unfortunately, it was an asymmetrical power situation where I was in a room full of a lot of Zionist sympathizers, but I had a teacher, she was my English teacher, who really saw like the passion that I had in wanting to articulate my feelings on this situation. I think I share that to basically say that I realized that my high school wasn't the place to do this. It wasn't productive, and in some ways it was more traumatizing to me than anything. But I did get the chance to engage with what was called the Princeton Committee on Palestine at Princeton University. So I made it, you know, a goal of mine to create, we have these things called senior projects. And I did my senior project. It was a short film compilation, as well as, you know, commentary on the Nakba. And that came out of my organizing very early on. I was like 16 or 17 years old with these college students who really taught me the ins and outs of campus organizing. So that's, I think, Anis was mentioning earlier, you know, that's the stage that was set. And I laughed to myself a little bit because, you know, I was like really lost. You know, I think most like young Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, or even just people of color, when you're in a predominantly white space, you're just like, where do I get my identity? Like, how do I ground myself? And for me, a part of it was actually like Tumblr. And I don't know if you remember, but I was like heavy.
Oh, I remember.
I was heavy on Tumblr, right? And so it was there that I was fortunate enough to, in the midst of like this organizing with the Princeton Committee on Palestine and observing the bombardments in Gaza and just like internalizing all of this trauma, right? I came upon this program called Go Palestine. So at the time, I think that the PCP were actually organizing they were doing like an action against Birthright on Princeton's campus. So I was really aware of like, okay, there's a program, it's called Birthright, you know, Jewish people of Jewish descent can get free subsidized trips paid for by American tax dollars and other wealthy Zionist donors to visit my homeland. And it dawned on me, I'm like, I live and breathe Palestine, but I've never been to Palestine. Like, how can I get there? And I just remember one day I walked out of my room. I was like in a cave just searching on Tumblr. I said, Mama, I'm going to Palestine. And she said, what? And I was just like, yeah, I found this program. It's run by the Ramallah Friends School. And I'm going to go to Palestine this summer. And it was a summer that right before my 16th birthday. So I would say that was like a pivotal moment for me, because that program offered me the opportunity to see Palestine in front of my eyes. And I remember leaving the Jisr, the crossing, the border crossing, and driving through Ariha and literally sobbing, because it just was so surreal that I had finally like touched ground on, like literally breathed the air and touched the soil of Palestine that I never thought I would see. I don't know, Anis, do you want to like, I feel like I came back a change.
That gave me goosebumps because I sadly, although I was like really, really close to Palestine while I was in Jordan for those years in high school, I still have never gone to Palestine. So I think my mom and our grandparents are the only ones, and maybe like some uncles, are the only ones to really have gone to Palestine or have lived in Palestine, but were exiled and expelled. So I've never been, so I didn't have that experience yet. And I'm counting down, hopefully, inshallah, to be able to have that experience. And I'm just, you saying that makes me feel like I need to really, and I know this. And I think it's part of the reason why I never went while I was so close to it, while I was in Jordan, is that I need to prepare myself for all of the emotional labor that it's going to take to stomach going back home and finally, you know, going to Palestine. So when you just said that, I remember, you know, I was younger than Mesa when all of that was happening, when she said she found this program and wanted to go. And, you know, my parents made it happen, even though it was probably a financial stretch for us. They still made it happen for her to go. And it was just so surreal to be like, oh, yeah, you know, where's Mesa? Oh yeah, she's in Palestine. She went back home. So I'm just really like counting down to when that experience happens for me. I don't know when it'll be, hopefully soon, because I also, like Mesa, live and breathe Palestine.
One of the things, like I'll say that I remember leaving Palestine, and I spent Ramadan in Jordan after that. So this was summer of 2012. And, you know, I left and I remember calling my mom, one, sobbing, because I just couldn't, like, it felt like I was being like ripped from like the womb of my mother, but like the motherland, you know, like I still can't put to words how beautiful and painful it was, because what I witnessed in Palestine in person and not through a screen, you know, until that point, it's like I had been consuming every single documentary, movie. I was listening to Shadia Mansour. I was listening to them. They came to Princeton University and I was like consuming everything that had to do with Palestine. But when I went there, the starkest realization was the power of white supremacy. And I say that because immediately after my departure and return to America, it's not like it was lost on me, the immense power and connections that white supremacy has between the empire that is America and the colonial empire that is Israel. I think I made a commitment to myself in that moment that not only was I going to dedicate like my life to Palestinian liberation in the form that I can contribute, right? Because resistance and liberation, it's comes in so many different ways. It's not just going out to protest. It's committing yourself to learning, to praxis, to theory, to all of these things. But for me, it was moving in lockstep, like in stride with indigenous peoples, right, that are struggling still for their own liberation on this land that is occupied, that we live on. You know, I'm here on Turtle Island on stolen land, and it's like I can't wait to get back to my homeland because we don't belong here at the end of the day. But also just being in solidarity and learning about how the way that Black liberation is intrinsically tied to the liberation of Palestine and vice versa, right? And making sure that the communities that I engage with and that engage with me, that allow me into their space, see that connection. Something that weighs heavy on me right now just is how deadly white supremacy is. And I grapple with that often, I think, particularly as, like Anis mentioned, you know, we were so fortunate to have thought leaders like Cornel West, Angela Davis. Like, the exposure to these people at such a young age gave us the ability to understand, like, wait, there is an effort, there is a movement through violence, right, to eradicate the presence of Black peoples, of indigenous peoples, of Arab peoples, of anybody that threatens the hegemony of empire. And that, like, sounds like a lot of jargon, but I think nothing is more apparent than watching the way that Israel not only murdered Shirin Abu Akleh point blank through a sniper, but then proceeded to desecrate and not let the Palestinian people lay this member of our community to rest in the midst of her funeral. I mean, I've seen a lot of horrific things that Israel has done to Palestinian people. And we've also seen the horrific manipulation that they engage in across the ocean, all the way in America. But to watch them in this moment, I mean, Palestinians, like, I told you that I watched the second Intifada happen on TV. Shirin Abu Akleh was the person who covered the massacre, the attack of Jenin, the village that we're so fortunate. Our youngest sister, her name is actually Jenin. She was born in 2003, right, Anis? I'm like forgetting everyone's birthday.
Yeah, 2003.
She was born in 2003, right, at the time that the Israeli army was occupying Jenin illegally. And so I think it was the most heartbreaking, but also the most sobering moment to watch Israel so unapologetically show their true colors. And in some ways, I am so grateful for the power of social media and the way that that footage disseminated so quickly. The lies that they tried to concoct around her murder just fell short. I mean, they were just false, right? This idea that Palestinians are killing their own. I mean, it's the same argument that we see when, you know, liberals in this country, who I think are quite honestly more terrifying than conservatives in this country, but liberals in this country using the argument of Black on Black violence and intra-community fighting is like the reason for racism or violence or whatever it might be. So it's just, these narratives are so transparent. And I feel wholeheartedly, I'll just say one thing, is like, people tell me, they're like, don't you get tired? You know, like, Palestinians, like, well, you guys aren't going to be free because Israel and America, they're just so strong. And I always tell them, I say, whenever I feel hopeless, I look to abolitionist Maryam Kaba. And I know that a lot of people quote this, but she says, hope is a discipline. So when I feel hopeless, I lean on that strength and I draw from her and the legacies of all of the leaders that we've had in our movements that have sacrificed, you know? And I am hopeful. I really am. In Arabi, we say, when they were attacking Sheikh Jarrah, there was a woman interviewed and she said on camera, she said, اقتربت الساعة, the time has come. And I do truly believe that the time will come.
I think that I just want to also build off of what you just said about looking to our elders and things like that, especially when it comes to cross movement building and solidarity work and practicing revolutionary love every day towards yourself, towards your allies, your comrades, and the people who you claim to fight for. I think that also it's really important, just like our radical revolutionaries from the Black Panther Party did, is coming out and writing statements and making these, you know, saying it with your chest, I guess that's how I would say it. Yeah. And putting your words to action is the next step. And demanding these statements isn't just lip work or lip service. It's putting your principles on paper. And I think that that's so important. And materially uniting and coalition building through statements and things like that is also a part of the process. And it's something that I've learned as an organizer in the Boston area and with the Palestinian youth movement and things like that. And I think that educating one another with our struggles and learning from each other is also a form of resistance, because we have to first be educated and reach a collective consciousness to be tactical and make targeted action that can be taken effectively and seriously. So when all of these protests erupted for Black Lives Matter and when they erupted for Sheikh Jarrah and for Gaza, there were strides to make this coalition building and make this movement last. And I think that that's something that really excites me and Mesa probably too, I hope.
Oh yeah.
And also, like you said, you mentioned this many times, Mesa, imperialism. You used all these big words, but recognizing that Palestine or Black liberation, they're not just human rights movements. I'd go further, and that they're part and parcel of defeating world imperialism, and as the most absolute and violent form of capitalism. So that means reminding our movement and people and comrades in our movement that class analysis is central to how we move forward with helping Palestinians on the ground. That's always something I remember. The workers, the farmers, the people who on a daily basis are fighting Israeli occupation and Israeli capitalism and Israeli imperialism, but also the Palestinian comprador and the bourgeoisie class who pose a huge roadblock to our national liberation, and making sure that all of these connections are being made across borders. So in the United States, the discourse on capitalism and imperialism and all of that, I would hope it's pretty solid in that, you know, for example, people in my generation are starting to really become radicalized, and there are a lot of social media, like, you know, all of these, like the slides on Instagram.
Oh, the infographics, yeah.
The infographic world on capitalism and why capitalism is bad, but also going the next step and being like, capitalism is bad on a global level, on the level that implicates our Palestinian siblings, on the level that implicates our movement for liberation across the globe, in Somalia, who's being bombed by who? By the United States, in Kashmir, right? Like, all of this is intertwined and it goes hand in hand. And so I think the thing that helps me get through things the most and not lose hope is knowing that there are people, there are comrades who are dedicated and committed to building the movement and to growing the movement with really valuable principles and ethics.
You said that so, so beautifully. And I will say that I am really confident in the way that discourse is changing. And it's based on like a confluence of, you know, different events coming together. You know, Anis mentioned, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, and I hate just calling it Black Lives Matter movement, because I do think, I don't know if you recall, but there were pictures going around, you know, Palestinians for the Black Intifada. Like, this is an uprising. It really is, you know, in the same way that my heart breaks when we saw Ahmed Arakat, for example, last year, murdered in cold blood, and then his body withheld by the occupation forces in this weird psychological torture to not allow Palestinians to mourn, you know? I see that in the same way within the Black community, the way that the deaths, the murders of our Black siblings in this country, one, there's this desensitization, but two, there's this way, this narrative to whitewash their murder at the hands of police brutality. And one of the parallels that I saw that I can't shake till this day is when George Floyd was murdered and people took to the streets. It was the middle of COVID, the beginning of COVID, actually, right? People were unemployed, okay? They couldn't even, the failures of capitalism were so stark. The system is unsustainable, and people were starting to call it out. And despite all of this, I saw the most beautiful coming together of community organizers led by not only the Black community, but Black women, Black trans folks that are always at the front lines of every single movement in the city.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I, for once, oftentimes I think Palestinians were like at the forefront, we're leading things. I took a step back and I said, I want to listen and I want to learn. And to be in solidarity means to listen to the needs of our Black siblings in struggle. So I remember very vividly the day before Trump had his like photo op in front of the church downtown. We had been out there the Sunday before. That Sunday, they had blocked off Lafayette Square, which is right in front of the White House, so the grounds that are in front of the White House. And people had been out there protesting for days. They had the military, they had the park police, they had MPD. I mean, the sheer amount of militarized police that were in front of unarmed protesters was so just, I mean, unsettling. And I remember that I saw people down in the streets and liberals that you wouldn't think were galvanized, right? But I said, oh my gosh, like there are actually people here that are out and protesting. And we witnessed like mutual aid in a way that I don't think I've ever seen in the wider DC area. I mean, people were pulling together water, food, sunscreen, I mean, everything from baby formula. Like it became not just, all right, let's support protesters, but hey, let's support the communities here that are unable to literally feed themselves because COVID has put them out of work. And then despite that, right, despite the community showing care and love for one another and supporting one another, later that evening, Mayor Bowser put in place a curfew. And Anise, I don't know if you remember, but I opened up my live stream on Instagram that day. Because
yeah, I remember.
It was, I mean, like it was intense and it was heated. And the military police began to shoot rubber bullets, I kid you not, through the trees at our heads. My friend Parker and I were literally standing on a bench to elevate ourselves so that we wouldn't be in the line of fire. I mean, there were people getting treated for injuries. And yeah, they kettled us on a side street to literally distract, right? So I share all of this to say that in that moment, I witnessed the parallels of militarization in a way that I felt like I was in Palestine. I felt like we were in Palestine on the ground being attacked by the IDF. And I think that one of the most beautiful but heart-wrenching things that I saw was like, it was young Black teenagers that were at the forefront, literally taunting, you know, in the, like, what else are we going to do? Taunting these militarized police and like seeing how angry they were, the police, like at the fact that we could come together, like our numbers outnumbered them. So, you know, when I say that, like, I'm committed to combating white supremacy, like I think of those moments and I'm so fortunate to be in community with people like that.
I think that what you just said is the material unification of all of our people, not just being Palestinian people, but people who are suffering under a post-colonial world that is in its highest state of imperial capitalism. And it's just, it was crazy because I wasn't in DC for those protests, but where I was, it was, you know, just as violent. It was just as scary. It was just as much of a risk to put yourself on the street and to put yourself in front and sacrifice, being able to put your solidarity into action. And I remember people calling out to white people that were in the protests and saying, get to the front, because they won't shoot you if you're white. And I was like, yep, that's exactly what needs to happen. And they went to the front, not all of them, but, you know, the ones that were willing to actually sacrifice. I think also another thing for me in terms of staying hopeful and not burning out, which is something that I've had to deal a lot with, and I think a lot of people have had to deal with it, is for me, what I do is I stay hopeful by thinking of history, thinking of successful liberation movements like Algeria, like Haiti. And I maintain hope by, this is going to sound funny, but like, you know, obviously like reading and reflecting on those histories, but like listening to like revolutionary music and nationalist songs and things that give me joy and give me life and give me the power to continue and make me feel a little bit closer to home and to our people. And keeping in touch with everyone on the ground and just, you know, lending a listening ear when I can. For example, during the bombardment on Gaza last year, when everything was happening in Sheikh Jarrah as well, I had my Instagram DMs were flooding with people. And particularly this one moment, I can't forget it. Someone told me, how am I, young Palestinian from Palestine, he said, how am I supposed to keep living when all they want us to do is die? He was his morale was so low. He was in a very dark place. He was stripped of his youth and the joy of being a youth in this world, because he saw people that look just like him, that are just his age, being brutally murdered, bombed, and it just, it puts a lot of things into perspective, and it makes those moments of reflection on privilege all the more important, because at the same time we are dedicated, we're fighting, we're in solidarity, we're not on the ground and we're fighting different fights. And that doesn't mean that our fight isn't just as just, it's not just as right, it's not a fight worth fighting. No, of course it is. But I think a lot of the times I find myself reflecting on the privilege that we have to not be put in those situations at the same time. Like, yes, we're on the streets fighting for Black liberation. Yes, they're using the same military weapons and guns and rubber bullets and tear gas canisters. But at the same time, I don't know, it still doesn't feel like the same experience to me. Yeah. And I feel like that was just the point I wanted to get across, was that there are a lot of parallels, but I also, something I like to do, especially through social media, is by conversing and talking to people on the ground in Palestine, is hearing how they feel about everyone's sort of sometimes making these parallels between Palestine and the Black Liberation Movement. And that's not to say that they aren't valid and that they aren't right, because they are, they exist. And the parallels are there for a reason, because of the global structures of imperialism and the nature of colonialism and things like that. But at the same time, it's really making sure that we pay attention to context and paying attention to that, I think, is really important.
I think you said something that was really important about resistance and the way that you draw power from resistance as it comes in the form of art and music. And one thing that I love to say when people are like, well, you're so radical, you know, you want to abolish prisons, you want to abolish capitalism, you want to abolish the police and the military and blah, 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 blah. And that they see that as kind of like a threat, you know, radicalism being so scary. But like, I think what's at the crux of radicalism, and something that I contemplate on often, is the fact that radicalism is really rooted in deep love and empathy.
Yes, exactly.
And like wanting to uplift not just your peoples, but all peoples in struggle. And resistance isn't, you know, DC is a place where everybody kind of wants to be that activist. And I really push back against the term activist, because to be an activist means that you act single-handedly in almost like a vacuum. But to be an organizer, to be in community with, means you have to listen to the people around you, and you need to react, or you need to organize based on the situational material circumstances that you live in. And so the way that we as Palestinian women, right, contribute to resistance is so much more than just being out in the streets. It's the way that we support our communities. It's the way that we can lead as a people in political education, reminding ourselves not just of the leaders, but of the lessons. There's this tendency, I think, of folks to like let go of past moments in either Palestinian history, in the Black Liberation Movement, because of failures that people highlight. But in some ways, those failures teach us lessons, right? So I'm thinking, you know, of Leila Khaled, I'm thinking of George Habash, I'm thinking of Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael, and right? These people, they didn't leave us with failures. They leave us with lessons that we have to take into account and put into practice.
I want to just say one thing, especially you kind of pointed out like who we are in this. We are Palestinian women. We are Palestinian community members and organizers and things like that. And I think for me as a young Palestinian woman, in the many moments that I felt like a loss of hope or feeling helpless and whatnot, there's this one quote, and I do really want to read it because it sort of accentuates everything that we've been talking about, especially from the perspective of my perspective as a young woman, and I think Mesa's as well. It's from Leila Khaled. She says, "I have learned that a woman can be a fighter, a freedom fighter, a political activist, that she can fall in love and be loved. She can be married, have children, be a mother. Revolution must mean life. Every aspect of it." And I think that for me, that helps me ground myself and remind myself that at the end of the day, we all have a role to play. We can all wear many hats. We can all do many things. But at the end of the day, if we aren't dedicated to revolution, every single aspect of our life, then we'll never get there. And it gives me a lot of power and strength to know that there are so many people that are dedicated to living revolution, to practicing revolution, to being radicalized. And obviously, Queen Leila gets a shout out. But yeah, I'm just so glad that we were able to talk about this all and put all of these feelings and emotions that we have into words.
I think that the most beautiful thing about all of this is that people have this like resistance to like learning and theory. It's inaccessible, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, political education happens by being on the streets. Political education happens when you are living in this capitalist system that has like failed, or in this revolutionary space, and realizing like, okay, like there are labor politics involved here. There's so much disgruntlement. So when people push back and they're like, oh, I don't want to dismantle these systems, I don't want to sit there and read Frantz Fanon, it's like, all right, you don't have to read Frantz Fanon, but talk to your community, learn about, you know, what are the needs that can be filled. And like the multiplicity, I think, of identities and the way that we can contribute to liberation of all peoples is the most empowering thing there is. And the people in power, they want to exhaust us, right? They want us to throw our hands up in the air and say, I can't do this. But like, we have the power of numbers.
And we won't do that.
Yeah, we won't. Like, we have not just the power of numbers, but like, I not to be cliche, but I do think that the power of empathy and deep love will propel these movements forward.
Revolutionary love, my sister. Revolutionary love.
Revolutionary love. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think we could end on that. Revolutionary love to everyone. To Palestine, to the Black Liberation Movement, to the Indigenous struggle. Revolutionary love.